I'm Adrian Sala, and you're listening to Wikisleep. As many of you already know, I'm in the final stages of getting approval for the Wikisleep app in the Apple and Google Play stores, and it should be available in the next couple of weeks. If you'd like to receive an update for when it's ready, please visit wikisleep.com and add your name to the list. This evening, I'm going to read to you about the Great Chicago Fire. A massive blaze that burned between October 8th and October 10th, 1871. It killed an estimated 300 people, destroyed roughly 3.3 square miles of the city, and left more than 100,000 residents homeless. The fire is believed to have started at about 8:30 p.m. on October 8th, in or around a small barn belonging to the O'Leary family that bordered the alley behind 137 DeCoven Street. City officials never conclusively determined the cause of the blaze, but there has been much speculation over the years on a single start to the fire. The most popular tale blames Miss O'Leary's cow, who allegedly knocked over a lantern in the evening. The O'Leary family denied this, stating that they were in bed before the fire started, but stories of the cow began to spread across the city. Catherine O'Leary seemed the perfect scapegoat, as she was a poor Irish Catholic immigrant. During the latter half of the 19th century, anti-Irish sentiment was strong throughout the United States and Chicago. This was intensified as a result of the growing political power of the city's Irish population. Furthermore, the United States had been distrustful of Catholics, or Papists as they were often called, since its beginning, carrying over attitudes in England in the 17th century. As an Irish Catholic, Miss O'Leary was the target of both anti-Catholic and anti-Irish sentiment. And sadly, the story of her cow was circulating in Chicago even before the flames had died out, and it was noted in the Chicago Tribune's first post-fire issue. In 1893, the reporter Michael Ahern retracted the cow and lantern story, admitting it was fabricated, but even in his confession, he was unable to put the legend to rest. Although the O'Learys were never officially charged with starting the fire, the story became so ingrained in the local lore that Chicago City Council officially exonerated them and the cow in 1997. At the same time, others believe that a group of men were gambling inside the barn and knocked over a lantern. But regardless, the fire spread was aided by the city's use of wood as the predominant building material in a style called balloon frame. As contrasted with platform framing, in which each floor is framed separately, with balloon framing, the studs extend the full height of the building from foundation plate to rafter plate, meaning the fire can easily climb. More than two-thirds of the structures in Chicago at the time of the fire were made entirely of wood, with most of the houses and buildings being topped with highly flammable tar or shingle roofs. All of the city's sidewalks and many roads were also made of wood. Compounding the problem, Chicago only received 1 inch of rain between July 4th and October 9th, causing severe drought conditions before the fire, while strong southwest winds helped to carry flying embers toward the heart of the city. The Chicago Fire Department had a scant 185 firefighters with just 17 horse-drawn steam pumpers to protect the entire city, which had a population of around 330,000 people. The initial response by the fire department was quick, but due to an error by the watchman, Matthias Schaefer, the firefighters were sent to the wrong place, allowing the fire to grow unchecked. An alarm sent from the area near the fire also failed to register at the courthouse where the fire watchmen were. At the same time, many of the firefighters were slow and tired from having fought numerous small fires and one large fire in the week leading up to the blaze. All of these factors combined to turn what could have been a small bonfire into an inferno. When firefighters finally arrived at DeCoven Street, the fire had grown and spread to neighboring buildings and was progressing toward the central business district. Firefighters had hoped that the south branch of the Chicago River and an area that had previously thoroughly burned would act as a natural firebreak. All along the river, however, were lumber yards, warehouses, coal yards, barges, and numerous bridges across the river. As the fire grew, the southwest wind intensified and became superheated, causing structures to combust and catch fire from the heat. Around midnight, flaming debris blew across the river and landed on roofs on the Southside Gas Works. With a fire now across the river and moving rapidly toward the heart of the city, panic set in. About this time, Mayor Roswell B. Mason sent messages to nearby towns asking for help. When the courthouse caught fire, he ordered the building to be evacuated and the prisoners jailed in the basement to be released. At 2:30 a.m., the dome of the courthouse collapsed, sending the great bell crashing down. Some witnesses reported hearing the sound from a mile away. As more buildings succumbed to the flames, a meteorological phenomenon known as a fire whirl developed. As overheated air rises, it comes into contact with cooler air and begins to spin, creating a tornado-like effect. These fire whirls are thought to have carried flaming debris high and far, accelerating the spread. Debris was blown across the main branch of the Chicago River to a railroad car carrying kerosene. The fire then jumped the river a second time and began raging across the city's north side. Despite it spreading and growing rapidly out of control, the city's firefighters continued to try to battle the blaze. But a short time after the fire jumped the river, a burning piece of timber lodged on the roof of the city's waterworks. And within minutes, the interior of the building was engulfed in flames, and it was destroyed. With it, the city's water mains went dry, and Chicago was helpless to fight back. The fire burned unchecked from building to building, block to block, decimating all in its path. Then, finally, late into the evening of October 9th, it started to rain. But by this time, the fire had already started to burn itself out. After the fire ended, the smoldering remains stayed hot for many days, slowing a survey of the damage. Eventually, though, the city determined that the fire had destroyed an area encompassing more than 2,000 acres. Destroyed were more than 73 miles of roads, 120 miles of sidewalk, 2,000 lampposts, 17,500 buildings, and $222 million in property, which was about a third of the city's valuation in 1871. The day after the fire, on October 11, 1871, General Philip H. Sheridan came quickly to the aid of the city and was placed in charge by a proclamation given by Mayor Roswell B. Mason, which read, "The preservation of the good order and peace of the city is hereby entrusted to Lieutenant General P.H. Sheridan, U.S. Army." To protect the city from looting and violence, Sheridan installed martial law for 2 weeks, enforcing it with a mix of regular troops, militia units, police, and a specially organized civilian group called 1st Regiment of Chicago Volunteers. Former Lieutenant Governor William Bross, who was part owner of the Chicago Tribune, later recollected his response to the arrival of General Sheridan and his soldiers, saying, "Never did deeper emotions of joy overcome me. Thank God, those most dear to me in the city as well are safe." For 2 weeks, Sheridan's men patrolled the streets, guarded the relief warehouses, and enforced other regulations. Of the approximately 330,000 inhabitants of Chicago, almost 100,000 were left homeless. 120 bodies were recovered, but the death toll is expected to have been much higher. The county coroner speculated that an accurate count was impossible, as some victims may have drowned or been incinerated, leaving no remains. In the days and weeks following the fire, monetary donations flowed into Chicago from around the country and abroad, along with donations of food, clothing, and other goods. These donations came from individuals, corporations, and cities. New York City gave $450,000 along with clothing and provisions. St. Louis gave $300,000 and the Common Council of London gave 1,000 guineas as well as 7,000 pounds from private donations. In Greenock, Scotland, which had a population of just 40,000, a town meeting raised 518 pounds on the spot. Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Buffalo, all commercial rivals, donated hundreds and thousands of dollars. Milwaukee, along with other nearby cities, helped by sending new firefighting equipment. Food, clothing, and books were brought by train from all over the continent. Mayor Mason placed the Chicago Relief and Aid Society in charge of the city's relief effort. Operating from the First Congregational Church, city officials and aldermen began taking steps to preserve order in Chicago. Price gouging was a key concern. And in one ordinance, the city set the price of bread at 8 cents for a 12-ounce loaf. Public buildings were opened as places of refuge, and saloons were closed at 9 in the evening for the week following the fire. Many people who were left homeless after the incident were never able to get their normal lives back since all their personal papers and belongings burned in the blaze. After the fire, A.H. Burgess of London proposed an English book donation to spur a free library in Chicago in their sympathy with Chicago over the damages it had suffered. Until this point, libraries in Chicago had been private with membership fees. Then in April 1872, 7 months after the blaze, the City Council passed the ordinance to establish the Free Chicago Public Library, starting with the donation from the United Kingdom of more than 8,000 volumes. The fire also led to questions about development in the United States and led many Americans to reflect on industrialization. Based on a religious point of view, some said that Americans should return to a more old-fashioned way of life and that the fire was caused by people ignoring traditional morality. On the other side, progressives believed that there was a lesson to be learned from the fire, that cities needed to improve their building techniques. Frederick Law Olmsted observed that poor building practices in Chicago were a problem and wrote, Chicago had a weakness for big things and liked to think that it was outbuilding New York. It did a great deal of commercial advertising in its housetops. The faults of construction, as well as art in its great showy buildings, must have been numerous. Their walls were thin and were overweighted with gross and coarse misornamentation. Olmsted also believed that with brick walls and disciplined firemen and police, the deaths and damage caused would have been much less. Almost immediately, the city began to rewrite its fire standards, spurred by the efforts of leading insurance executives and fire prevention reformers such as Arthur C. Ducat. Chicago soon developed one of the country's leading firefighting forces. At the same time, business owners and land speculators such as Gurdon Stalston Hubbard quickly set about rebuilding the city. The first load of lumber for rebuilding was delivered the day the last burning building was extinguished. Interestingly, the city of Singapore, Michigan, provided a large portion of the lumber to rebuild Chicago. And as a result, the area was so heavily deforested that the land deteriorated into barren sand dunes that buried the town, and the town had to be abandoned. The Palmer House Hotel, which burned to the ground in the fire just 13 days after its grand opening, was one of the first to undertake a new build. In its construction, it claimed to be the first fireproof building. Within a very short time, Chicago had become the standard for which city planners and engineers would look for safety planning. And a little over 20 years after the Great Fire, the World Columbian Exposition of 1893, known as the White City, was lit up using innovative electric power supplies that dazzled all those who attended. The Columbian Exposition hosted more than 20 million visitors during the event, much of which was hosted in the exact area that had been completely razed to the ground in the Great Fire of Chicago.